From the studios of KXCI Community Radio in Tucson, Arizona, I'm King David McKenzie with the Unvarnished Truth. Here's some of how the world is treating itself today, the 20th of July, 2009. If you've eaten at a McDonald's in Milan, Illinois, near Rock Island recently, you may have gotten a break you didn't deserve. Health officials say as many as 10,000 people who stopped at the restaurant along Interstate 80 from July 6 to July 10 and or on July 13 and 14 may have been exposed to the potentially deadly liver disease hepatitis A. If you ate at the McDonald's, you may be eligible for free hepatitis A vaccines if you are age 40 or younger, or immune globulin if you're age 40 or over. One of their employees with the disease worked on those 7 dates, while another infected employee was diagnosed with hepatitis A on June 17th, but health officials weren't informed of that diagnosis until 3 weeks later. 19 cases of hepatitis A have been connected to the restaurant thus far, with 11 of those victims still hospitalized. The McDonald's in question was closed and cleaned by the Rock Island Health Department. Of course, by now you've heard incessantly of the death of Walter Cronkite Friday night. New York City, complications of a disease that hampers blood circulation to the brain at 92. I do confess to a certain level of admiration of Cronkite, mainly as an icon of my childhood. He wasn't the only reporter to stoke my boyhood fascination with the U.S. space program at the time, as equal credit is due the late Jules Bergman of ABC News. Having seen the first hour's worth of video coverage of the three U.S. television networks' coverage of the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963, I also cannot say that Cronkite's anchoring on CBS was the best. NBC, which used several different anchors, was clearly better, and note must be made of ABC's Ron Cochran, now forgotten except by hardcore trivia buffs, but still displaying a courageous effort under hideous circumstances. All three are visible either at archive.org or on YouTube. The main reason that Cronkite gets so much credit for the Kennedy assassination coverage is, quite frankly, familiarity. NBC's main anchors for that day were Frank McGee, who died after a few years of hosting NBC's Today program in the early 1970s, and Bill Ryan, who performed brilliantly that day but was familiar mainly to New York viewers as the local anchorman on WNBC-TV. To most in Tulsa, Green Bay, and Seattle, Ryan was a stranger then and remained a stranger afterwards. But it was Cronkite who was and would remain most familiar to most viewers. Another face on NBC that day, David Brinkley, would be seen almost every week for over a decade after Cronkite's retirement from the CBS Evening News, but Cronkite's manner would be what worked for most viewers. It's a factor that Dick Gregory once attributed to President Franklin Roosevelt on radio during the Great Depression and the Second World War. To paraphrase Gregory, if you've just survived a particularly traumatic car crash, the calm and steady voice of the policeman, as they arrive and check on you, has a tremendously positive, comforting effect. Cronkite's Midwestern baritone was always calm and steady, and his time as a news anchorman, 1962 to 1981, with the war on Vietnam, the Kennedy and King assassinations, urban rioting, and Richard Nixon in the White House, was an amazingly traumatic time for the United States of America. There is one other nit to pick in CBS's own coverage of Cronkite. They pulled out an old clip over the weekend of Cronkite claiming that he, not Ed Sullivan, introduced the Beatles to American television when airing a piece about that group on the CBS Evening News of December 10, 1963. Not only was that inaccurate, Cronkite was actually third in line. According to Bruce Spicer's exhaustively researched book, The Beatles Are Coming, a book to which Cronkite contributed a foreword, coincidentally. The first appearance of the Beatles on American television actually took place over NBC on the Huntley-Brinkley Report of November 18, 1963. The reporter filing the piece in New York with British-originated film was Edwin Newman, and the anchorman introducing the piece was Chet Huntley. They deserved the credit for that piece of trivia, although no copy of the report or broadcast appears to have survived in NBC's archives. The piece that Cronkite referred to, filed from London by CBS correspondents Alexander Kendrick and Josh Darsa, had actually run 4 days after the NBC piece on the CBS Morning News with Mike Wallace. It was scheduled to run on that evening's Cronkite broadcast, but other events of that day intervened. November 22, 1963, of course, on which President Kennedy was assassinated. Cronkite waited until December the 10th, by which time the cloud of gloom for JFK's death was beginning to dissipate, to run that piece. However, Cronkite does deserve credit for a different point of Beatle trivia. It was that December 10th broadcast that led teenager Marcia Albert of Silver Spring, Maryland, to request a Washington, D.C. disc jockey, Carol James of WWDC, play the Beatles. James arranged for British Overseas Airways Corporation, or BOAC, as in the Paul McCartney lyric, "Flew in from Miami Beach, BOAC," in back in the USSR, to fly into Washington with a copy of the latest Beatles single to be issued by their British label, Parlophone Records. Once it arrived, James brought Albert into a WWDC studio to record an introduction to the record, and on the Carol James program of December 17, 1963, the introduction and the record were played back. The record was "I Want to Hold Your Hand," a piece of plastic inherently more exciting than the number one hit on the Billboard Hot 100 that day, "Dominique" by the Singing Nun. When was the last time you heard that record on an oldie station? WWDC immediately started playing the hell out of that record, and James sent tape copies of the record to disc jockey buddies at WLS Chicago and KXOK St. Louis, who also started playing the hell out of the record. In addition to all of this, the Canadian wing of Capitol Records had issued another pair of Beatle recordings, "Roll Over Beethoven" and "Please Mr. Postman," back on November the 25th as a 45 RPM single, and influential top 40 stations near major stateside markets, including CKLW Windsor, booming into Detroit and Cleveland, and CHUM Toronto, which easily reached Buffalo across Lake Ontario, started playing the hell out of those sides. This forced Capitol Records in the United States to move up the scheduled release here of "I Want to Hold Your Hand" from January 13, 1964, to the day after Christmas of 1963. So, for directly prompting the first United States airplay of the biggest hit record of 1964, Walter Cronkite truly deserves a spot in Beatle history. Just not the spot that CBS was bestowing on him over the weekend. Having said all that, I must further admit that during the time period where my personal interest in world affairs and Cronkite's tenure on the CBS Evening News overlap, roughly mid-1970 to 1981, I didn't watch Cronkite's news all that frequently. Throughout this period, I lived in eastern Wisconsin, where the ABC affiliates in Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Chicago usually carried that network's evening news, with Harry Reasoner and Howard K. Smith for the first half of that span, at 5 p.m. Central Time. My family would usually watch that one, then tune to NBC for John Chancellor and David Brinkley. Chancellor and Brinkley were generally considered to be the best writers among the network anchormen, a claim Chancellor openly admitted he himself held in an interview with a New Zealand television magazine in the late 1970s, probably thinking word of his boast wouldn't surface stateside, which it eventually did. And I have to admit, I still think Chancellor was the best of that group. Among the very few audiobooks I own is a cassette copy of Chancellor's Peril and Promise, and it's one of my favorite nonfiction books I've ever read. But Cronkite always held the strongest image, and his appearances on other CBS programs always kept his image strong in my household, too. In fact, one early childhood memory was reawakened by the flood of Cronkite images over the last weekend, from the 1960s morning when the late Bob Keeshan, as Captain Kangaroo, asked Cronkite to appear on the Kitty Show to explain to the small fry how elections were supposed to work. I say how they were supposed to work, as I probably watched that broadcast in Kenosha, Wisconsin, over Chicago station WBBM TV Channel 2. And Chicago elections, to say the least, are among, shall I say, the most legendarily unique in nature among all American ballot experiences. Anyway, that brief flash of Captain Kangaroo and Uncle Walter holding prop ballots reminded me of a time when television programming was actually at its best. Sure, there was dreck like the Beverly Hillbillies and Lawrence Welk bleaching the soul out of the latest pop hit melodies every week, but there were also Rod Serling creating memorable short stories on The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery, Jack Parr and Dick Cavett holding intelligent conversations with very important people in prime time, and Ed Sullivan bringing circus acts and opera, and the Beatles, to poor urban and Kentucky kids whose parents would never afford the ticket price. The vast wasteland was populated by waterholes and lush oases more frequently than most people at the time would care to admit. And having the choice of Brinkley and or Chancellor on one channel and Cronkite on another was one of those choices we sorely miss in today's broadcast marketplace. As they say around the South, Cronkite was standing in some pretty tall cotton. Was Cronkite ever as relatively hip as, say, Tom Snyder in the 70s or Linda Ellerbe in the 80s? Of course not. But that wasn't his function. One of the most overused cliches in recent years is from pole vaulting and high jumping about how high the bar is raised. Everybody talks about the bar being jumped or vaulted over, and nobody says a word about the poles with the notches that stand alongside and hold that bar up. That was the function that Cronkite served. And that is why I believe his memory should be honored. Other obituaries over the weekend include Gordon Waller of the singing duo Peter and Gordon. World Without Love, I Fall to Pieces, Lady Godiva, and Woman were among their biggest hits both stateside and in their native United Kingdom. They also recorded one of my favorite Phil Oakes tunes called Flower Lady. Woman, by the way, was written by Paul McCartney without John Lennon's input, and just to see if it would sell without his name on it, the single carried a couple of pseudonyms, either A. Smith or Bernard Webb, in the composer's credits. The ruse was uncovered, and it sold well anyway. Norwich, Connecticut, heart failure, at 64. And Frank McCourt has passed away. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his 1996 memoir of an impoverished childhood in Ireland, Angela's Ashes, which spent 117 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, 23 of those weeks at number one. New York City, melanoma at 78. The world's oldest man since last month, and one of the United Kingdom's last living veterans of World War I, is no more. Henry Ullingham had published his memoir, Kitchener's Last Volunteer, only last year. He was 113 years old. Also dead is Steve Rothenberg, the president of Lionsgate, the film-releasing firm who, among other items, took over distribution of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 after the Disney company tried to suppress it so that the Dick Cheney administration wouldn't get pissed off at them. Before Lionsgate, Rothenberg was at Artisan Entertainment and created the massively successful marketing of the independent horror film phenomenon of 1999, The Blair Witch Project. Los Angeles, stomach cancer at 50. And jazz singer Dee Dee Belson has died only 5 months after her father, legendary jazz drummer Louis Belson, died in February. Her mother, Broadway star Pearl Bailey, died in 1990. Charlottesville, Virginia, heart attack at 49. Sue Burns is also gone, majority owner of the San Francisco Giants baseball team. San Francisco, from a cancer that she'd been diagnosed with only 9 days previously, at 58. And one of the first of the so-called Bond girls is also gone, Zena Marshall, who played Miss Taro, the Chinese double agent in the first theatrical James Bond film, Dr. No. Also had been a frequent player on the British television series Danger Man, screened on the American CBS network under the title Secret Agent, after a brief illness at age 83. And one of the pitchers for the 1969 Chicago Cubs has died. Al DiStasso only pitched for 4 innings that April for the club, after which he eventually moved to Los Angeles, where he retired from the L.A. Police Department in 1995. Macomb, Illinois. Cancer at 60. If you have any material you'd like for me to include in the next few days, just email me at baronofarizona@gmail.com. That's baronofarizona@gmail.com, and please indicate where you're listening to this program from. Oh, and one thing more today. After 6 years together, the relationship between a pair of male penguins at San Francisco's zoo is apparently over, with Harry establishing his bisexuality by leaving Pepper for another penguin, Linda. The Los Angeles Times reported on Friday that the relationship between Harry and Pepper, who lived side by side protecting eggs abandoned by other penguins, came to a relatively shocking end when Harry moved into a neighboring nest with recently widowed Linda. The development has sparked a variety of reactions in the blogosphere, where Linda has been called a homewrecker who lives for her own happiness no matter who gets hurt. Actual quote there. Harrison Edel, a curator of birds at the zoo, had a more pragmatic explanation, noting that Linda's recently deceased partner was leader of sorts among the small zoo penguin community, commanding not one but two nests. For penguins, real estate means a lot, Mr. Riedel told the Los Angeles Times. So, as far as penguins go, she was a pretty attractive prospect. With Pepper rejoining the ranks of the single, religious hate talk website OneNewsNow.com took the split as a sign that nature prefers heterosexual relationships, their claim. Others were much more sympathetic to the bereft Pepper. Another poster on the Frigging Loon blog says that he was heartbroken about the split and that he hopes Pepper finds another male penguin that is 10 times hotter than Harry. Apparently, monosexists abound in the blogosphere. Of course, if you don't like this news, you always have the option of making some news yourself. In Tucson, I'm King David McKenzie. Until tomorrow, have yourselves some peace and oranges.